It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. In today's show, we'll hear a harrowing snake story.
Hidey, hidey, hi, hidey, hidey, hey, there's a big black stain in my driveway. High as a house, low as a mouse, got more rooms than anyone's house. Hey, diddle, hi, hey, diddle, diddle, look inside, there's a possum in the middle. What is it?
We'll have that coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. Restaurant owners and food service workers in the Ohio Valley are worried about their livelihoods now that the governors in Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana have ordered all bars and restaurants to close to dine-in customers. The move is the latest attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus and raises further concerns about the economic impact of the pandemic. Becca Schimmel has more.
So you want the Chicken Ranch Club sandwich?
That's one of the regulars at Ray's Harvest House in Albany, Ohio, calling in an order for takeout. Owner Rachel Cottrell had to lay off 11 people following Ohio Governor Mike DeWine's order that all bars and restaurants close dine-in services. Denise Hager was a cook at the restaurant and says she'll miss seeing and talking to all her regular customers.
I don't like it, but then again, I don't have any control.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear also ordered bars and restaurants to end in-person dining to try to reduce the spread of coronavirus. Stacy Roof is the president of the Kentucky Restaurant Association. She says she understands why Beshear made his decision, but she's concerned about businesses across the state.
I'm disappointed for our businesses because I know they're fearful and they're trying to figure out how they're going to take care of their employees.
Roof says it's difficult for people in the hospitality business to stay home because the nature of the job is serving others. Economists across the region are recommending expanding paid sick leave to keep people home from work when they're feeling ill, as well as easier access to unemployment benefits. Governors in Kentucky and Ohio have waived the waiting period for unemployment benefits through executive orders. Michael Shield is with Policy Matters Ohio, an economic policy group. He says the unemployment benefits Ohio offers need to be expanded so that more workers qualify.
In Ohio, the earnings test requires that you earn $269 a week. A minimum wage worker in the state who works 30 hours a week doesn't qualify.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2018, more than 746,000 people worked in food prep or service-related jobs across the Ohio Valley. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel.
One of the reasons coronavirus is so scary is it's possible to be a carrier for the disease and not know it. Some people are asymptomatic and some people have mild symptoms. But as of Monday, West Virginia has only tested 84 people for coronavirus out of a state of 1.8 million. Critics say that's not nearly enough. So why have so few people tested? Carol Lofton reports.
If you wanted to check to see if you had coronavirus so you could make sure you're in the clear before going to visit an elderly relative, could you? The short answer, no. At least not in West Virginia.
So currently, I have enough tests and supplies and everything else to do maybe 500 people.
That's State Commissioner for Public Health, Dr. Kathy Slimp. And the only reason she has enough tests for 500 people?
I borrowed extraction kits from my flu testing to fill in, to expand my capacity.
In other words, people aren't getting tested because there simply are not enough supplies to test people nationwide. The state has put in an order for more kits, but supplies are on back order with no sense of when the order will be fulfilled. So Slim said she borrowed materials from flu testing kits so they can run more coronavirus tests.
I'm not stopping flu testing. In fact, it's actually really helpful for this because we try to exclude flu before we do COVID testing.
If someone has the flu, she says, it's highly unlikely they also have coronavirus. But because supplies are in high demand, for now, the only people who will be tested are those who meet a strict criteria. In a news release Monday, the DHHR specified tests would be reserved for really sick people already hospitalized with symptoms of coronavirus, people at risk of complications, including the elderly and those with pre-existing health conditions, or people at high risk of having been infected, which includes someone who has been to a current epicenter recently or has been in contact with an infected person. The DHHR says that their approach is similar to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines on testing. But the CDC guidelines have been a point of controversy, with other major public health groups like the World Health Organization saying the U.S. has not gone far enough.
South Korea as a country, they tested very broadly.
That's Dr. Clay Marsh. He's the vice president and executive dean of WVU Health Sciences. He spoke last week with West Virginia Public Broadcasting and explained different approaches and outcomes when it comes to testing.
And part of the way that they started to control the infection is instead of just asking everybody to self-quarantine if you've had any potential exposure, they started to test a ton of their population, so they actually knew who was infected and who wasn't. And optimally, you find that out, and you quarantine the people that are infected, and you don't quarantine the people that aren't. So that's really a step that we're moving toward, which will allow us, I think, to be much smarter about how we're approaching this from a public health protection standpoint.
As Marsh points out, South Korea has been lauded for its efficient testing. They made testing free and fast. Residents can pull up in their vehicle, get swabbed, and then get results usually the next day via text. Their death rate is 0.9%. In the United States, the rate is 1.7%, just about double. And to put that into more perspective, the flu has about a 0.1% mortality rate. And it's not just testing supplies that are the problem. It's that the labs don't have the technology necessary to test. West Virginia State Lab wasn't set up until Saturday, March 7th. Tests were sent instead to the CDC in Atlanta, and commercial labs didn't get going until this week. Some hospitals are also hoping to be able to run their own tests soon, but for now are having to send them off to external agencies. But with supplies on back order and few labs to test in, state health agencies say they have to focus on testing just those with the highest risk, even though they believe coronavirus to already be in West Virginia. And when it comes, it could be catastrophic.
We have a high-risk population.
Again, that's Public Health Commissioner Slimp. She says West Virginia has a high-risk population because the disease seems to target the elderly and those with pre-existing health conditions. She says it's great that we don't have any official cases, and now is the time to act to prevent a disaster, but that West Virginia likely will not be prioritized to receive supplies because other states have more cases.
You need to be prioritizing states not just on numbers of cases, but on risk. We have a high-risk population. If we don't have a lot right here now, that's great. If you send them now, we act now, we have a chance to really, really reduce it much more. If you send it just where it's already happening, you may be too late.
If you can't test everyone, she said, the only other option is to isolate everyone, reducing risk through contact. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Dave Mistich contributed to this report. Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Charleston Area Medical Center and Marshall Health. With thousands of children out of school this week, parents may be itching to find creative ways to entertain them. So here's a thought. There are lots of ways children can continue to learn and explore outdoors. And studies show that even just a little time outside is great for kids as well as adults. It can help reduce stress and stay healthy. Inside Appalachia Folkways reporter Sarah Lynch Thomason takes us to North Carolina to meet naturalist Doug Elliott. He spent more than four decades teaching kids about nature through storytelling and song.
On a humid afternoon near Leicester, North Carolina, about 20 people tromp through a field behind naturalist Doug Elliott. They're on a plant walk, exploring trees, flowers, and herbs. Doug leads the group up to a large tree and pauses.
Okay, everybody in a comfortable spot here? I got a riddle for you. And the riddle is partially an old Appalachian riddle, partially a new Appalachian riddle. It goes like this. Hidey, hidey, hi, hidey, hidey, hey, there's a big black stain in my driveway. High as a house, low as a mouse, got more rooms than anyone's house. Hey, diddle, hi, hey, diddle, little, look inside, there's a possum in the middle. What is it?
Black walnut.
Black walnut. All right, so black walnut. Well, a black walnut is high as a house. There's a tree right there. It's low as a mouse when the nut falls down. And then, but now, hey diddle diddle, hey diddle hi, hey diddle diddle. Look inside. There's a possum in the middle. What could that be about?
Doug takes out a black walnut shell cut in half. Everyone bends in to get a closer look.
Look at look.
The inside of the walnut shell looks just like a possum's face, with a narrow head and small black eyes. But Doug says not all of them look this perfect.
It takes a lot of nuts to get a possum, but we.
For more than 40 years, Doug has been telling stories and singing songs about nature. His passion for everything from salamanders to sassafras started when he was young.
I guess I remember as being a little kid, I can remember with it having a jar and a top and going out and catching bumblebees, holding them in the jar and slapping the top on there. I guess that was a real thrill to me.
Doug says his passion for educating others about the natural world started when he was living in New England after college.
I was an art major. I was totally unemployable, and I thought if I'm going to be an artist, I better start growing a garden. Started growing the garden, all these weeds came up.
Weeds, not what he was hoping for. But Doug says a friend had given him a book called Stalking the Wild Asparagus by wild food enthusiast Yule Gibbons. And after reading it, Doug realized that the weeds growing in his garden weren't useless. Some were even more nutritious than the plants he was trying to grow.
And it kind of opened the world to me, like, oh my goodness. I got so excited about that, I started giving talks about nature and about useful wild plants.
Since then, Doug has made a career out of storytelling. He now lives in North Carolina and says he settled in Appalachia because people here have a deep connection to the land and they're willing to share what they know.
I mean, most information you learn from the old-timers comes with a story, you know.
Now in his 70s, Doug is the old-timer, so to speak. His work helps kids learn about nature at a time when most are spending less and less time in it. Doug says loose, unstructured time outside is an important outlet for the unbridled energy of childhood.
The nature can be such a sponge for all this kind of undisciplined, testosterone-ridden craziness, you know.
One of Doug's biggest fans is a 5-year-old named Forrest.
Do you have any favorite plants or flowers that grow around here?
I like pine trees, and I like maple trees, so we can tap them and get the sap and boil them to make it into boiled syrup, maple syrup.
That all sounds delicious.
Yum.
Forrest and his father, Kevin, live in a house on a rural mountainside in Barnardsville, North Carolina. During the evening, you can hear tree frogs and crickets right outside their door. Kevin tells me that Forrest spends a lot of time in the woods, watching tadpoles and deer. A few years ago, Forrest found some secondhand tapes of Doug's stories and songs, and Kevin says that Forrest was mesmerized by them.
There was probably a 3 or 4 or 5 even month period where he listened to these Doug Elliott tapes every day. He would he learned how to work the tape player. He would sit down on my bed and listen to Doug Elliott for 25 or 30 minutes, easy, sometimes more.
All right, so now we need to
push this button.
Forrest fast forwards the tape player to one of his favorite tracks, then starts reciting stories right alongside Doug's narration.
All right, snake. I know you're out there hiding in those bushes somewhere. I know you're out there hiding, snake. You should be ashamed of yourself. How dare you not show up for the great council? You better come out, snake.
Doug Elliott has a lot of stories about snakes. One of Forrest's favorites is about a non-venomous snake called a black rat snake. It lives near farms and eats rodents. The story is about a time that Doug gently squeezed a black rat snake to help it regurgitate a plastic egg.
Doug Elliott squeezed an Easter egg out of a snake, and that snake came to his pet, and he kept it a little while and let it go, and then it just kept going away and coming back, going away and coming back, and I think it still does that.
Kevin tells me that not too long ago, he and Forrest spotted a black snake near their house, but Forrest wasn't scared. He was excited because he'd heard songs and stories about snakes. I told Doug about Kevin and Forrest's black snake encounter.
That warms my heart. If you ask me why I'm doing this, that might be one of the reasons.
One of the reasons, to see kids like Forrest delighting in nature. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Sarah Lynch Thomason.
That story was part of the latest episode of Inside Appalachia about the benefits of getting outdoors and tapping into our love of the wild. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. More information on how to subscribe is at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director and producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.